Welcome to the Fuzzy Mike. Fuzzy Mike. The interview series, the podcast, whatever Kevin wants to call it. It's Fuzzy Mike.
Hello, I'm Kevin Kline, and thank you for joining me for another episode of the Fuzzy Mike, where we get entertaining conversation about mental health and self-improvement. What happens when a young girl raised in one of the strictest Amish sects, the Schwarzentruber Amish in Michigan? What happens when she decides to leave that life behind at 17 to live in a world she doesn't realize she's completely unequipped to navigate? For my guest, Naomi Schwarzentruber, that decision plummets her into a hell that nearly kills her three times. Naomi's book, The Amazing Adventures of an Amish Stripper, an Erotic Memoir, which is available on Amazon, it's not for the faint of heart. I read the entire book. The eroticism is blushworthy. The exploitation she endured is absolutely infuriating. And honestly, many of her own decisions will leave you frustrated. And that's understated. I don't recall the last time a book has given me reactions this visceral. Now, likely much to my wife's dismay, I wanted to start this conversation off with Naomi to kind of bond with her, okay? And so I let her know that I live in rural Missouri. And whenever my wife and I drive north to Kansas City, we pass 7 horse and buggy signs that say share the road.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And so when my wife and I see, I believe they're Amish. I don't know if they're Amish or Mennonite. You can maybe tell us the difference, but we don't call them Amish or Mennonite. We call them share the roads.
Oh, that's awesome.
There's some share the roads.
That's awesome.
So let's talk about your story, because the book is, there are times in that book, Naomi, where I want to grab you by the shoulders and shake you.
I know, right?
I know, like more often than not. And so we're going to get into this book. But I want to talk about, so the book is called The Amazing Adventures of Amish Stripper, an Erotic Memoir. Reading it, I felt like I was cheating on my wife a couple of times. Holy smokes, dude.
I know, right? It's very spicy. The erotic scenes are very spicy, so.
Very spicy? I'm going to say that this is like ghost pepper spicy. It's a very intriguing memoir. And to get to where you are now, we have to start at the beginning. Tell us about growing up Amish, because you were Amish until you were 17, right?
Yes. So I was born into the Schwarzentruber Amish, which is one of the strictest sects, because there's a lot of different kinds of Amish, strict and less strict, and I was one of the strictest ones. And there, we have to wear long dresses down to our ankles, and they all, like, we can't roll the sleeves past our elbows. Our hair has to be covered, and we have to wear a bonnet, and we can only wear dark colors. And as a little Amish girl, I always liked the color pink, but it was forbidden, and it was almost taboo to talk about. So I love pink, and I like to wear lots of pink, but back then I couldn't. And we farmed with the horses. There were no tractors, no cars. And we traveled by horse and buggy as well. If it was too far to go with a horse and buggy, one of our neighbors would take us in their vehicle. So we were allowed to travel in vehicles, but not drive them, obviously. And to travel interstate between states, we would travel by Greyhound or train. And then, like, we had a big farm when I grew up. We had over 20 milking cows. We milked the cows by hand. We had 150 chickens. So by the age of 5, I was waking up early and setting the table. I would feed the chickens and fill the wood box and help with cooking and cleaning and things like that. Obviously, not like full on like my mom did, but I would help her out even at a very young age. And I actually enjoyed it because it made me feel like I was part of the family by helping out. And that's what my whole family did. We helped each other out, and we had 3 meals a day that we sat together and ate. And that was always my favorite time, was meal time, because we all got to be together and joke and laugh and talk about our day. And there's 12 of us. I have 7 brothers and 4 sisters, and I'm number 4. So I come from a large family. And I started school when I was 6. and they only go to eighth grade. We have a one-room schoolhouse with about 20 to 30 students, one teacher. Sometimes if there's closer to 30 students, the teacher has a helper. And the teachers are someone, it's someone that's out of school but not yet married generally. So
when you say one of the strictest sects in Amish, you guys did not have indoor plumbing.
We did not have indoor plumbing. We had an outhouse. Now, growing up until I was 12, until my parents bought a farm, we rented a farm and we lived in a tiny little house. And there were 11 kids already in 3 bedrooms. It was super tiny. And there the outhouse was like set back from the house. And we would, even in the winter, like it was horrible. We had to go outside. And when I was there, we did not use toilet paper. We would use newspaper and we would like crumble it up to make it softer. And I remember going to my grandma's house and there was toilet paper and we always kind of joked like, oh, she's too fancy or too good to use newspaper. But after I left and I would go back to visit, now my family uses toilet paper too. But yeah, it was not fun to go outside to use the outhouse in the winter.
So what do you do for showers and bathing when you're in Michigan at this time and Michigan is very cold in the winter?
Yes. Yeah, so in the winter, our kitchen in this little house, we had like, it was like a separation. One side was for the kitchen table. The other side was our cooking stove. So we only took a bath in the winter once a week, which was Saturday nights. And we had to heat up all the water for everyone. And we had a big galvanized tub. A couple of kids would take a bath. And then we have to use buckets and empty out the tub and refill it and heat the water and stuff like that. But we used the wood stove in the kitchen. And that's where we would take a bath in the winter. And in the summer, we would do it in the wash house. And the wash house was very close to our house.
You guys had a generator. If I read correctly in the book, you had a generator. What was that used for?
We didn't have I guess maybe they're kind of like generators. We couldn't have like a generator, but they're little Honda engines. Okay. And if that makes sense, they're like the little, you can buy them at Harbor Freight. I don't even know why my dad got them, but we would use those to run the washing machine and also to pump the water from the well and to run the table saw to cut lumber. So we were allowed to use those little Honda engines to do things like that. And my dad also had a sawmill, which took a big engine, and he had a big stationary diesel engine that he ran a belt from the sawmill to this engine. And that's how he operated his sawmill.
And you said that if you're going across state lines, you have to go by train or bus. Where do you get the money for those tickets?
Well, back when I was there, we made money from the farm. From milking cows, we would sell the milk. And then my dad had the sawmill. So he cut lots of lumber. We got money from that. We also sold baked goods and vegetables and things like that. So growing up, my family was pretty poor. So they didn't travel that much. I actually only got to travel once when I was like between two and three, I think. And I have very vague memories of it. My uncle got married in Ohio. So they don't travel that often. At least back then they didn't. I feel like they travel a lot more now than they used to.
Okay. And you did not grow up exclusively with Amish neighbors. You had, and you call them English neighbors, correct?
Yes. Everyone that's not Amish, we call them English. Even doesn't matter what country they're from, what language they speak, everyone's English. I'm English now too, according to my family. So, yeah.
Not only are you growing up in a very strict environment and you're limited in what your religion and your family will allow you to do, but right across the street, you've got kids who have all these English freedoms. How did that play into your desire to leave?
When I was 13, we got new neighbors and they had a daughter that was 11, and she was literally just as fascinated by us as we were by her. And she started coming around all the time. And my parents weren't happy, but they kind of tolerated it. And we also started going to their house a little bit more. And that's when it opened my eyes. I was like, wow, she has a bicycle. She gets to wear sandals and paint her nails and wear colorful t-shirts and her hair is down and she can call her friends whenever she wants. She gets to watch TV and listen to the radio. And that just really, I was like, wow, that's so cool. And I started rebelling in my cousins. For some reason, at kind of at the same time, I don't know if it's because we were teenagers, we just started opening our eyes and noticing things a little bit more. And we started rebelling. And like, I bought English a couple t-shirts and shorts and a pair of jeans from a yard sale when I was 15. And then I also wanted to buy English panties, and my sister's from the yard sale. And she's like, you don't know where those were. Like, you can buy some at the dollar store next time or whenever we go to town. And sure enough, when we went to this store, we went right to the panty rack, and I was like, wow, it was amazing.
In the book, you actually describe wearing English panties going to church. And the one thing that you did not consider was what? People walking behind you.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I know. And I was actually, I did think about it, because I remember when people would walk behind, I would walk behind my sisters or my mom, you could kind of see the outline of their Amish underwear. And I would hope that no one would notice that I wasn't wearing mine. And then my cousins and I, we would go in the outhouse and we would show each other our English panties. And we thought we were so cool and awesome because we were wearing non-Amish underwear.
So were you the only one in your family with 11 siblings who wanted to become English, to who, based on what you saw across the street and your neighbors, who wanted to rebel? Or was there other siblings that decided, you know what, I think that's a lifestyle for me too?
Well, my, so there's two girls and one boy older than me. I'm number four on the kids. My sister, just older than me, her and I actually planned on leaving together. And we were going to run away with our two cousins that were the same age as us. But my sister and I, and ironically, my two cousins, they did run away kind of to get in that, like it was pretty close together. And then my sister and I, we actually got into an argument about this because we felt bad that if we both leave, mom only has one old enough daughter to help her work on the farm. And we felt guilty or bad to leave her like that. And finally, I was like, you know what, if I just run away first, then it's up to her if she wants to choose to leave them behind. Like, I know it's selfish. I was selfish, but I just wanted to leave. So I left, and then she left. I left in July, and she ended up leaving in October that same year, but she went back 8 months later, and she's married and has, I think, 12 kids.
Oh.
11 or 12 kids. Yeah.
Wow.
So she went back, and other than that, I always forget about this because I'm not used to it really. A couple of years ago, one of my younger brothers left with his wife and four kids. So they are not Amish, but it's, I don't know, it's kind of strange because I know they're not Amish, but I don't remember to call them often because I'm not used to it, I think. And sometimes when I talk about it, people ask me, I'm like, no, I'm the only one that left, but I'm not. My brother left too.
Well, what about your cousins that you grew up with who were kind of rebellious, like you said?
They left and they're still... Yeah, they're still English like I am, but my sister did go back.
So that answers my question. You could go back?
Oh, absolutely. I could go back anytime I want and they would accept me and take me in like nothing happened. I mean, maybe not like nothing happened, but I'm always welcome there. If I got married, then it would be a little bit more challenging. I wouldn't be able to get remarried Amish unless my English husband died. Because they don't believe in divorce. So once you're married there, that's it. And the only time they can get remarried is if, let's say I was Amish and I married and my husband died, then I could get married again. But other than that, they can't.
No, it really is till death do us part.
Yes, no, it really is. But yeah, I could go back. And my parents don't, before when I would go, they really pushed it a lot. But now when I go, they always say, you know, we still pray for you. And if you ever want to come back, you're more than welcome to come back. But they're not like, oh, please come back. Like, they're not like begging me to come back like before.
Yeah. How do Amish communicate without electricity and without, because you guys weren't allowed to have phones?
No phones. So they travel by somehow, you know, it's very interesting to me. Somehow news travels really fast among the Amish. Like, they know everything, even though they don't have TV or the news or phones. basically just when they see each other, they talk, they go by horse and buggy, and I don't know, it's a very close-knit community. So they're very supportive of each other, and they help each other out a lot, and they see each other quite a bit, I guess, and every other Sunday they go to church.
Is there an age at which an Amish boy or girl can take the reins of the buggy?
Kind of. I mean, it's pretty young. Usually when they start school, like maybe like second or third grade. I know when I was in third grade, I started to be able to take the reins and drive the buggy. And then my brother that was just younger than me, we would actually argue sometimes because he's like, I'm a boy, and he was used to working in the fields and driving the big teams. So he would oftentimes take the reins, but he did let me do it sometimes too, because it made me feel special to be able to drive the horse and buggy. And then, I don't know, I was probably like 10 to 12. I was able to go places by myself. I would take the horses. It was like my job to go take them to the, I think it's called a farrier where you shoe the horses.
Yes.
So on Wednesdays, I would take one of the horses, and I don't know, I always loved it. I felt so free just riding in the buggy with the horse. It was very peaceful.
How often do Amish go to church?
Every other Sunday.
That's it?
That's it. Every other Sunday. And so they work every day except Sundays. And the Sunday they don't go to church either. They stay home and rest and sleep and relax and play games. Or they can go visit another Amish family, or another Amish family can come to their house, vice versa. But yeah, only every other Sunday.
And is church held in church?
No, it's held at people's houses. They take turns holding it at someone's house. So it has to be a married couple and someone of the that's in the same church, that in the district and stuff like that.
And you, according to the book, you enjoyed the days where your family was the host, right?
It was fun. I didn't like leading up to it because we had to clean everything and it was like super busy and stressful. But the day of actual church, I enjoyed it because we get to have like these, we would make schnitz pies that we would bake on Fridays, and we would usually only make them for church, and they were for like the little kids during the church, they could eat them. But when church was at our house, we got to eat them, the leftover ones, and leading up to the church day. And they were made from dried apples, and then they would soak them, and they would make them into these little half moon pies called schnitz pies. So I always looked forward to that, yes.
All right. Now, we have been talking about the Amish upbringing that you had, and I'm shocked to find out that Amish only go to church every other Sunday. But that's not the most shocking thing I learned from your book, Naomi. Tell me about the singing and what happens after the singing.
When we're 16 and a half, we get to join the singing. And that's where after the church at 8 p.m. from 8 to 10, the kids that are 16 and a half and older that are not married gather and they sing. And if they want to date someone, that's when the boy gets to ask the girl. I imagine the girl can ask the boy too. And if they agree, and sometimes not even agree, they, like everybody has, it's called schnitzing. It's the first date. Everybody has to do it once they join the singing. So there was no boy in my community, my district that I was interested in, no Amish guy that I was interested in. But because I had to do this one Sunday night after the singing, some boys grabbed me and they're like, who do you want to date? And I was like, no one. And I ripped away from them and I got a few feet and they caught me again. Like more boys came to help and they threw me in the buggy with my second cousin. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. But I was in the buggy. I was like, I have to do this anyway. I might as well just get it over with. He tried to talk to me. I wasn't interested. And my sister. So they take the girl. The boy takes the girl back to the parents' house and they go into the girl's bed and they're supposed to like cuddle and kiss, but not have sex. And I didn't have my own bedroom. So my sister was like, you can use my bedroom. And again, he tried to, but I laid as far back to the wall as I could and I didn't let him touch me or kiss me. And he finally gave up and he was just there till like 4:30 in the morning. And then he left and I didn't sleep all night. I was just like, thank goodness he's gone.
And this is,
I wasn't interested.
16 and a half years old, and a date is to spend the night in your parents' house with another boy.
Yes. Yes. That's how dating works in the Swartz and Trooper Amish. And dating among the Amish is not all the same. I just want to say, be clear, like they all have their own rules, like different sects of how they date. But that's how the Swartz and Trooper Amish do it. Yes.
And how is there, I guess you said that there could be kissing, there could be cuddling, but no sex. How is that enforced if there's nobody in the room with you?
There's no one in the room and nobody ever talks to us about sex or anything like that. Like it's never discussed. You're just expected to, like, it's like this unspoken language. Like you're expected to do this and not question it and not have sex. It happens sometimes. And sometimes the girl gets pregnant. And for example, I have a couple cousins that this happened to. They got pregnant, even a niece. She got pregnant and she was 17 or 18. So her and her boyfriend, and they just got baptized and then they got married, when generally they don't get married until they're 21. And they had to get baptized at 18. The Amish, the Swartz and Trooper Amish, would get baptized. And then generally at 21, they get married, but they had to do it sooner because she got pregnant. So it does happen, and it actually happens quite a bit now, a lot more than it used to, I feel like, when I was there.
That was one of the frustrating things about the book for me, Naomi, is that you aren't taught sex in the Amish community. And then at 17, you leave, and you were exploited. You were taken advantage of.
Absolutely. And I didn't realize it at the moment that I was being taken advantage of or exploited. I had no idea.
Exactly. Exactly. So let me ask you, and when we talk about where you're at in your life right now, we'll go back to the fact that you only go to school until you're in eighth grade in the Amish community. But let's just jump right into, you leave. You actually run away. And who were the people that picked you up?
Well, it was a couple, actually, but I didn't know that. We'll call them Kevin and Christine, because that's
right,
their names
in the book.
But I met Kevin because my dad had the sawmill, but I didn't know him very well. And I was picking strawberries and by myself. And that's when I realized that I was like, oh, maybe he could help me out. And I just blurted it out. I want to run away. Please help me. I want to live with you. And he's like, you're crazy. You can't do that. But I don't know. He exploited me even before I left. Mm-hmm. Like he took me to the barn for a blowjob, and I know it was very uncomfortable. But after I left, I didn't know he had a wife and a son. I didn't leave to be with him. And they picked me up, and then I stayed with his mom for a couple months, but I was lonely and bored there. So they remodeled their room in their house and let me stay there. And after, like, I didn't know how to say no to him about sex. It was a horrible situation because Christine was like a mom to me. She was very kind and super nice to me, but yet here's her husband exploiting me and even like selling me to his, well, he didn't know that his neighbor was paying me for blowjobs, but I don't know. It was a very uncomfortable situation.
Naomi, in the entire book, Naomi, you have a difficult time saying no to anybody and anything.
Right.
Yeah. So,
I know.
So my question then is, did Kevin bring this out in you, or did the oppressive religion bring that out in you?
That's the thing. Like, I'm not sure. I really am not sure, but I feel sometimes like maybe it's because when I first left, Kevin exploited me. And so maybe that's how my thought process worked throughout my life for such a long time, because that's how I was conditioned when I first left. I didn't know how to say no to anyone. And I just kept being exploited and exploited. And it was like a pattern throughout my life.
It was a big pattern throughout your life.
Yes. And it's probably also from being repressed.
Yes.
And not knowing how to like deal with saying no to people or situations like that, because I wasn't taught about sex. So it's probably a little bit of both. That's what I'm guessing.
Well, also in the community that which you were brought up in, if I'm not mistaken, no is not a word in a woman's vocabulary in the Amish.
I mean, we get to say no, but it's not, I don't know. It's, I don't know, because like, I was only there until I was 17. And I feel like we were taught to be very obedient as children.
That's a great word. Yes.
So maybe it's part of not knowing how to say no, because I was raised to be obedient.
So how different do you think your life would have turned out if you hadn't met or had Kevin and Christina been the ones to pick you up when you ran away?
I would hope that it would have been a lot more positive, and not, I think I shoved down a lot of things and I just kept pushing them down. And I think that's possibly why I got into drugs so deep. I was numbing myself because I never dealt with that. And I felt such huge guilt for so long because I cheated on his wife. Like, we cheated on her. And I always felt like it was my fault because I didn't say no.
Well, I'm going to take exception to that, Naomi. I don't think you cheated on his wife. I think Kevin forced you to cheat. And you did not cheat on his wife. He cheated on his wife and he used you to do it. Right.
And I actually recently apologized to her and she said, well, he was my husband and he should have known better. And she's like, don't blame yourself, because I just felt like, I don't know, I felt like I needed closure, and to move on from it, I had to apologize to her. And I'm glad I did, because she read my book and she's like, I always knew anyway, because of the way you guys acted. But she's like, it wasn't your fault. He was my husband and he should have known better.
Yeah, he was. Are they not together anymore?
They're not together anymore.
Imagine that.
I know, right?
Yeah, imagine that. Yeah. So you ended up going back after you first ran away.
I did. My first boyfriend broke up with me, and I was just at such a crossroads. I didn't know. He took me to Minnesota, and there I am in a new state, not many friends. I was terrified, and I was very upset about the whole thing. And I was like, maybe my destiny is not to be English. Maybe I'm destined to be Amish. And I was like, I'll give it another try. And I felt really horrible after I was there. And because my family was so excited to see me, and they made all new dresses and bonnets, and they were just super excited that I was there. And after 10 days, I ended up leaving again. And I feel like that was probably harder for them, possibly, than the first time, because they were excited to have me back. And then I just like ripped all their hope out again.
Well, and the book does a fantastic job of getting us emotionally into you returning. I didn't feel bad for you when you left. I felt bad for your mother. I felt bad for your siblings. You know, I was angry at you for going back. I really was. I was angry at you for going back. Because all you wanted to do was be English, didn't work out, and you're like, oh, I'll just go back, knowing full well that you were going to leave again. You knew you were going to leave again.
It was like in my heart, like, I know it was horrible, and I'm mad at myself for doing that. Like, I still, like, I don't know that I've ever fully forgiven myself for that, because that was very wrong for me to do that to them and hurt them. Like, I can't imagine if my daughter like left and then she came back and she's like, oh, I love you, I'm here to stay, and then she just like takes off and like does this to me again. Like, that just, I don't know, it's I wish I didn't do that.
Yeah. Definitely. I wish you didn't do that, Naomi.
I know, right? Seriously.
But here's the beautiful thing about this, okay, is that you ripped the hearts out of your family, not once but twice.
Right.
But they accepted you back that time, and they still accept you back to this day. And they have just the same amount of love for you that they did when you were still with them.
Yes.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel, it's unbelievable, because like, I feel guilty for doing that to them, but it just makes me realize how awesome and exceptional that my family is, because even through all of this, they still accept me and love me and accept me just the same as they always did. And that makes me feel bad because of what I did to them. Like, it's really unfortunate,
but it's a true testament to their level of forgiveness.
Yes.
And how they actually live what their religious teachings preach.
Right. Exactly.
You know, a lot of English, a lot of Christians, you know, will say, oh yeah, sure, I can forgive, but bullshit.
I know, right?
Yeah. No, right.
That's the one thing about the Amish. They're the most forgiving people. And not just my family. Like, it's the Amish in general. Some people have this bad outlook on the Amish, and I'm like, they're actually the most forgiving and really awesome people. Like, I'm really grateful for them. Super grateful that they allow me, and they love when I bring my daughter there. Like, it's unbelievable how awesome they are.
Well, I don't understand how somebody could be anti-Amish. You guys don't do anything to us. You know, you're a very peaceful community. As far as I know, you're a very peaceful community. And I mean, I'm going to be flat out honest with you. When we see Amish people in the store, you're like zoo animals to us. You're like, oh my God, there they are.
That's awesome. You know, the biggest thing that I get from my social media that people get mad when I post nothing about animals, but they're always like, oh, you guys run puppy mills. You abuse your animals. Like, you're the most horrible people. And I'm like, okay. First of all, I don't argue with them, but first of all, our animals are our livelihood. If we don't take care of our horses and our cows, how are we going to survive? Like, that's how we live they take good care of their animals. And sure, the dogs have puppies, but we don't, like, at least in my community, I can't speak for all of them. At least in my community, I never heard of puppy mills ever, not even once. And the people in my community did not abuse their horses and cows. Like, they were very well taken care of.
Yeah, I don't imagine how you could, because you are so dependent upon them.
Exactly. Yeah. So that, I feel like, is a huge, like, misunderstanding. And, like, again, I don't know about all of them, but just because there's a few bad apples don't make all of them bad, if you will.
Your relationship with your father growing up, it's pretty strained, even when you're in the house, because he's a very stoic individual. Right.
And he was, yes. And he was, I don't know. He was a man of few words, if you will, kind of, mm-hmm. But he was a businessman, a very awesome businessman, if you will. Like, he always had a lot of things going on, but I always felt like there wasn't time for us. And I can understand if you have 12 kids, like,
I was going to say,
how can you, you know, pay attention to all of them and run a farm and a sawmill and make money to support all of them? But I think my father is an amazing man. And now we have this unspoken agreement between the two of us. Like, I accept him and I don't expect him to. We have boundaries. We accept each other's boundaries, if you will. Like, he doesn't talk to me much, but he's nice to me. And he plays with my daughter when she comes. He just loves her. It's so cute. It's amazing.
Well, one of the tenderest moments of the book you share with the readers is that on Sundays, when your dad would shave. On Saturdays, when your dad would shave, yeah. He would do what?
He would come. Oh, I could barely reach his desk. It's one of my first memories. And he would put a dab of shaving cream on my nose and, like, it would make me giggle, and he would tickle me sometimes. And I don't know. Those were very special memories and moments that I would have, that I had with my father.
Well, they're very special moments in the book. You know, like I said, it's a very tender moment, and you would not expect that based on the description and the personality that you portray him to have, and which is quite understandable. But how was love expressed in the Amish community?
So through actions like that, like, they don't ever tell us that they love us, but, like, for example, they would take us, I don't know, it wasn't that often, but, like, the shaving cream and stuff like that, or they would choke with us and stuff like that. Like, during mealtime or after mealtime, we would talk and laugh, and it was more things like that. Like, we, as a family, we knew we were loved and that we all had our place in the family. And I guess other than that, I don't really know how he expressed it, but I always knew that they loved me, even though they didn't say it or do stuff like that. So
how is discipline meted out?
Discipline, they would spank us. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if we were really bad, they would get we had this black belt.
Oh.
But they wouldn't, like, beat us. Uh-huh. They wouldn't, like, leave marks on us or anything. They would just give us a couple whacks on our butt with the black belt, but oh, when the belt was coming out, I was like, oh no. But I mean, they disciplined us by spanking, and I don't do that to my daughter, but that's, I always say they did the best that they could with what they had and how they were taught.
What would necessitate that level of discipline?
Like lying or being really bad to, like if we got in a big fight with our brother or sister sometimes, stuff like that.
How do you but, not with 12 siblings under one roof?
Exactly. No, you know? It's going to be fights, yes. Or I don't know. Maybe it's something I blocked out. I'm like, I didn't get spanked very often. It was, and if we got in trouble at school, if we did, like, got in trouble at school, if we got spanked or had to stand in the corner at school, we would get spanked at home.
What do they teach you in Amish school that you only go to eighth grade?
It's reading, writing, math, and spelling. And like in second grade, we have to learn how to speak English and write in English. And also it's like phonics and stuff like that. And then in fifth grade, they teach us to read, write, and spell in German. But I already knew how to do that. I didn't know how to spell that much, a little bit. I knew a lot of it already because all of our prayer books and Bibles are in German. So on Sundays, when we didn't have church, my mom would teach us how to read from the Bible or the prayer books. And I was pretty young when I could start reading in German. Yeah. But no history, no science, or anything like that.
So, I mean, as far as like being able to do math and read, I mean, you're equipped to go out into the world. But
oh, absolutely.
But worldly knowledge, not quite there.
No, not quite there. Exactly.
So how foreign was it to you when you left the Amish community at 17?
Oh, it was. I was 17 and rebellious and I knew everything. But after I left, I was like, oh, I really don't know anything hardly about the outside world. And even though I had imagined it was like this full of bliss and everything was just super awesome, it was very challenging for me at times to get used to it because I didn't know really anything about the outside world. Like even going to a drive-thru the first time, I was like, what is this? Like, why are we talking to this thing on the side of the car? It was really scary for me and a very big culture shock. Or going to Walmart the first time, like I just froze because I'd never been in a big store. I never had to go shopping for clothes. I still don't like to go shopping for clothes because it's overwhelming. I never had to do that when I was Amish. But it just, there were a lot of culture shocks and it was a lot more challenging than I had imagined when I left. And sometimes I was like, I just want to go back. But I was like, no, that's all I wanted was to leave. So I'm going to hang in there and make the most of it and learn and do what I have to do to survive out here.
So because you've been English longer than you were Amish, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Like you're 17 years old when you left Amish and you're well over 20 years now in the English community.
I'm going
to
be 44 next month. So I've been out for almost 27 20, years.
Yeah. And you look like you still need to be carded, kid.
Thank you. It's awesome. Not sure how all the things that I did in my life, but.
And that's what we're going to get at right now. How do you maintain your youthful appearance? How do you maintain a full set of teeth when you were so addicted to drugs?
I don't know. Sometimes I think it's because of how I grew up eating like healthy food and all, like we grew our vegetables and everything. Like we didn't eat processed food. So I feel like that contributed to it. And even though we only brushed our teeth on Saturday nights, I know it freaks people out when I tell them that. When I left, I did have 14 cavities and I got them taken care of. And I don't know, I guess I just, over the years, I brush my teeth twice a day and I'm a very big flosser. And then as far as keeping my youthful look, I'm super into eating healthy and not a lot of junk food or processed food. And I take like amino acids and I just like spirulina and things that are good for me that nourish my body because food can be medicine and food can also make you very sick. So I, over the years, even when I was a crackhead and I didn't eat for for 3 days sometimes. I don't know how my teeth didn't fall out. Honestly, I'm not sure how they didn't fall out, but they didn't. And I just, that was like two and a half years of my life that I did not take care of my body. Yeah. And I don't know. I'm lucky. I'm grateful, if you will.
How lucky do you think you are to be alive?
Extremely lucky, because, and I'm sure we'll get into that, but I had, because of the drugs, number one, I'm very extremely lucky to be here, because I almost overdosed one time and I had a near-death experience, and I write about that in the book. And then when I was in Vegas, that my ex-boyfriend tried to kill me as well. So I'm extremely grateful to be here today and speaking with you.
And at one point, you did contemplate killing yourself.
Oh, absolutely. There were a couple times, actually, that I was like, I just want to end it.
So was that a factor of depression, or was that a factor of the amount of drugs you were using and didn't see a way out?
Both.
Okay.
It was, I was very depressed, and I just felt like I was just in this hole, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger, and I just couldn't crawl out of it. And it was just, I felt like there was no light. I couldn't it was just so much darkness. And I just was like, if I could just end it all, like it would, all the pain would go away.
And what stopped
you? I'm grateful that I did it.
What stopped you?
My family, actually. I would think about my family. And deep down, I knew that somewhere I had the strength. I just had to keep digging. And I was determined not to give up. Uh-huh. Because even though I wanted to so badly, there was some, like, this little voice, like, on my shoulder, like, you can do this. Like, you're better than that. You can get away from this and be strong and live a happy life again.
Well, in the book, you definitely feel that you wanted to get out of the situation that you were in, constantly using drugs, going from guy to guy. A part of me wants to know, do you think you were ADHD?
It's a very big possibility. It's a possibility. I've had people tell me that before. I've never been tested.
Uh-huh.
But it's a possibility, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I got that impression in reading the book, and the, you know, your attention span for a guy was maybe a couple of weeks, maybe a month or two, and then boom, on to the next, and then boom, on to the next. It was almost like Kleenex.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't blame you, and I don't fault you for that, because you didn't have a working knowledge of relationships coming out of the Amish community, and you didn't know what love actually should feel like or should be.
Right. And I feel like I felt so lonely and lost that I was reaching out and searching for love, or someone just maybe even just not to save me or to be there for me. And I was searching, and it just, I don't know, I guess I just clung on to people, and then it didn't work out. And then I was just on this cycle.
Well, it's you go from seedy guy to an even seedier guy to an even seedier guy. And right. At one point, I'm just like, would you just stop going and looking for guys? Because everyone seems to be worse than the previous.
Right. And I realize now that I was looking and searching for love outside of myself when I should have been looking inside and loving myself. Because if I don't love myself, no one's going to be able to love me. I'm not, you know, and I didn't realize that then. And I was searching for it out there when I should have been in here, looking for it in here.
The guest that I just had on last week, Naomi, she was a former Playboy Playmate. And that's what you just said exactly what her message is. You have to love yourself before anybody can love you.
Yes, and I realized that now. And back then, I don't know. I didn't know, because growing up Amish, like, I wasn't really taught about love. And then being exploited right when I left, I feel like it just was like this big thing that, I don't know, kind of boiled over. And I didn't know how to bring it back and love myself.
Yeah.
And I was just searching for it out there.
I mean, in talking to you, and I knew because I watch a lot of your TikToks, and you know, I did a lot of research on you. I read the entire book. Okay.
That's awesome.
I did. I read the entire book.
I believe you.
And I want people to protect you. I know that you're harder than hard because of, you know, stripper, prostitute, drug addict, crackhead. I know you've been through hell, but I just want someone to protect you.
Well, I feel like I kind of have that person in my life now.
Yeah.
My partner. He is unbelievably, he's magic. He really is. And he's the first person really in my life, besides one of my girlfriends that, well, actually I have a couple girlfriends, but the first guy that saw me for who I was, I didn't have to lie to him. And I was very open about my past and he didn't judge me. He didn't look at me any different because I told him. And we were just friends at first. And then I didn't even realize that I was attracted to him or I wasn't looking for a relationship like that. But man, he's really amazing and he's really helpful in protecting me, if you will, at points where I need and guiding me sometimes and be just being there, even if it's a listening ear, he's there and bouncing off. I have like a someone I can bounce ideas off or he's amazing.
See,
I'm so grateful for him.
Your relationship with him reminds me of my relationship with my wife. Okay. It was born of friendship. Okay. And yes. the number one attribute that he must have from you is trust and honesty.
Trust and honesty. If you don't have that, then it's not going to last and it's not going to go anywhere. And I have both of those with him and I'm really grateful.
Did it take you a long time to realize that you deserve that?
A long, long time. And I always did things to compromise my relationships.
Oh, did you? Really? I read the book.
It's terrible. I don't mean to laugh, but yes, I know.
No, I think it's great that you can laugh.
I wasn't doing it consciously, I don't think, or like I wasn't trying to, but it's just something that I don't know. I don't know why I did those, why I would compromise them. And
because it's what you knew.
Right.
It's what you knew. It's what you were taught. It's what you were taught by Kevin, who picked you up when you ran away the first time.
Right. To be dishonest and.
I mean, you're old enough to make. I blame him for a lot. Okay, and I hate that you named him Kevin. By the way.
Oh, that's I didn't think about that at all. I'm so sorry, Kevin.
That's okay. Now you know that at least one nice Kevin exists. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's definitely not all to blame because I was old enough to make decisions.
That's what I was going to say, but
I take responsibility for my part.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was in the wrong. I know that. And I just want to say that I've had to forgive myself because it was not just his fault. Sure, I wasn't quite an adult, but I was considered to be a young adult. And
age-wise, yes, but you were not equipped for those decisions. You were not equipped for those decisions. Okay.
I really wasn't.
No, I know. And it's amazing where you are now. From where you first started when you were 17 years old and you left the what you call Amishville to become English. There's some names in the book that I want to talk about. The first one is Dan.
Oh, let's rest his soul in peace. He was amazing. He just wanted to help me. He was honestly like, I still feel bad for Dan because all he ever wanted to do was to guide me and love me and support me and not let people hurt me. That's all he wanted. And I would kind of just push him away.
Kind of.
It makes me sad to think about that, how much I pushed him away.
So I
didn't accept him.
No, you didn't. You accepted all of his gifts and you accepted his money.
Not his love.
Yeah, he met you while you were stripping.
Right.
Why didn't you? I mean, I wanted you so bad to be with him.
He was in his 50s.
Uh-huh.
And I was young. So I looked at him more like a dad figure.
Yeah.
And I felt like if I was with him, I wouldn't be able to like live my life and he would control me. But I don't know that he really would have like. He never tried to have sex with me and Rowan in the book. He often tried to make us have sex, but Dan was like, no, I don't want to. She doesn't want to. But I don't know. It was really hard. And I wasn't ready at the time to get away from the drugs. And it was very selfish of me what I did to Dan. And I
well, you weren't alone. Rowan had a lot to do with that as well.
Okay. Absolutely.
So Dan retires from work. And how long did it take you to blow through $250,000 of his money?
Like 6 months.
Jesus.
I know. It's awful. It's absolutely, it's so disturbing to me to think about. Like, it's unbelievably horrible. And all he wanted to do was to save me, but he felt like he had to smoke crack with us to be with me because he didn't want to lose sight of me again because he didn't know where I was for quite some time. And he once told me he went driving up and down the streets in Grand Rapids and Muskegon where prostitutes were known to walk because he just wanted to find me, to save me. Even though I never told him at that time that I was selling myself or smoking crack, he knew what I was doing. He was a very smart man. He was an engineer and just he was very smart and in tune with me more than I wanted him to be at the time. And gosh, he tried so hard. And it breaks my heart that the way I treated him.
Yeah. And he's since passed on.
Yeah, he passed on.
Yeah.
He had a very weak heart. And I always worried that he was going to have a heart attack when he would smoke crack because he had a pacemaker and only a little bit of his heart, actual heart, was working at the time. But, you know, at least we got to hang out, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Better to have loved and lost than never loved at all. Right.
Exactly. Yes. And so, he just was such a good soul.
Yeah, you could just tell. You could tell in the book. You do a great job of capturing his essence in the book. Awesome. Yeah, that he was just there to look out for you. You
he
know?
Really was.
Yeah.
Like and he then, wanted me to come home with him and live. Like he's like, you can just stay here. Like I won't bother you pretty much. Like you can just be here and get well. That's all he wanted to do was for me to get well.
And instead of you getting well, you made him bad.
Yes. Horrible. I don't mean to laugh. It's terrible. It's awful.
That's the fact, though.
But it is the fact. It's really what happened. I did. Exactly.
And it wasn't, I mean, yeah, you made the decision to be a drug addict, but it was the drugs that were working on him. It wasn't right. You. It was the drugs that were in you that were working on him. So
right.
The other person I want to ask you about, and I think Randy is his name in the book.
Oh, gosh. Which one's Randy?
That he would take you to Vegas.
Randy. Yeah,
on the airplane.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Did you ever feel, I don't know, sheepish? Did you ever feel, sheepish is the best word, calling him and saying, I just blew through all that money again. Can I get more money and will you take me back out to Vegas?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would do that. And he was also such a nice older gentleman. I mean, sure, like he would give me oral sex, but he never wanted anything from me other than that. He also wanted me to get my life together. And I felt horrible when the money would run out because I promised him that I wasn't going to go smoke crack with those boys. He called them those boys. He's like, you better not go below this money with those boys and smoke crack. And I was like, oh, I won't. And when I made that promise and I would tell him that, I really in my heart felt like I wouldn't because when I was in Vegas, I didn't think about smoking crack. I felt like a human again. But that's when I realized I had to get away from them if I ever wanted to be clean. Because as soon as we were going back to the airport, I thought about them. And boom, that feeling came down back in my stomach where I would get that craving. I call it that horrible craving that would make me nauseous. And sometimes I would throw up. Like, it was awful. But yeah, he was also a nice, nice older gentleman that was trying to help me.
And you got all this money in Vegas by winning and gambling.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would take it back. And even sometimes before we would go anywhere else, we would go to it's like a crack house or my friends that were smoking as well. And then we would end up calling the dealer. Sometimes we would even go to the dealer before we would go there after I came back from Vegas with all this money. And I don't know. It was a horrible cycle I was stuck in.
A horrible cycle you were stuck in that only kept getting deeper and deeper and deeper. Deeper. What was the bottom point?
The bottom point was when I was up for 5 days and I hardly ate and I didn't sleep for 5 days. And I talk about this in my book, how I went to the bathroom and like my period came and like my whole life flashed before my eyes and I I was dying. I felt literally I was like slipping away. My soul was like trying to get out of my body. And I think I had an outer body experience because like I felt like I was dragging myself down the hallway to go talk to Rowan and Dan. And I was yelling their names, but they wouldn't look at me or come help me. And finally, I just went back to the bathroom and I don't know. It was really horrible.
You were hallucinating.
I was hallucinating. Right. Obviously yeah. Hallucinating. And finally, Dan came running and he just started crying when he saw me because there was blood all over the bathroom. It was bad. It was a very bad situation. But that was like when I hit rock bottom, I feel like.
And that was when you decided to move permanently to Las Vegas?
Not yet. I decided to move into an apartment. I was like, we need to get out of a hotel. We were staying at hotels at this time. So we got an apartment and we all like did a pinky swear. We're never going to smoke crack again. Like the apartment was off limits. And then Dan went away and Rowan and I couldn't help ourselves. We're like, just this one time. And then we would smoke crack in the apartment and I would run out of money. That's when I was going to Vegas. And eventually I met this guy, Lance, in the book. And after that, I decided to move to Las Vegas to get away.
And when you moved to Vegas, how soon was it before you started to go to the strip clubs and work?
It was like 10 days. Yeah. I started working at Spearman Rhino. I worked there for a couple months, but I felt like I didn't really belong there. It was too much, too overwhelming because it was such a huge place. And there were so many girls that worked at any given time. And I was like more like the girl next door. I wasn't the pushy stripper. Like I was the bubbly, fun, outgoing stripper. And then I started working at Cheetah's and there I loved it. Like I did really well when I started working at Cheetah's. The house mom was really nice. The girls were really nice. And I felt like I had like this little Vegas family. It was amazing.
As an Amish girl, how were you able to take your clothes off in front of people the first time?
My gosh, it was unbelievably scary and crazy. I couldn't believe that I did it. Like when they pushed me through that door on the stage and they had told me the first song I have to take my top off and the second song I have to be completely naked because it was a nude strip club. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's no way I can't do this. I can't do it. And they're like, sure you can. And my girlfriend's like, yes, you can. You got this. And I was like trying not to cry, but it was overwhelming. My hair, actually, I let my hair fall in front of my face and I was like, oh, that is my shield. They can't see me. I know they could, but in my head, they couldn't. Uh-huh. So that's how, even if I went to go dance right now, I would let my hair fall and be my shield.
So because, did you ever get comfortable?
Yes.
I mean, it reads like you got comfortable in a very quick time.
I did it. It was like about... when I was in Minnesota dancing at the first place, that was around 4 months. I never really got comfortable, like not 100%. Like I would always get super nervous and like tense. But once I would go on stage, the fear and the anxiety would just kind of go away because something would come alive inside me and I would get super excited and happy and it was fun. But the thought of going on stage was always really scary to me and overwhelming that first while. And then in Michigan, it took me a couple more months. And then the girls started teaching me pole tricks. And I don't know, then it was like amazing to go on stage. I looked forward to it. I would actually ask to go up, even if it wasn't my turn, if I wasn't busy, because I was so excited to go on stage and learn new pole tricks and just exercise. It was super fun. And to own my own sexuality for the first time in my life. It was very empowering.
There's a picture in the book that of you on the pole, and I can't remember where it was, but the story where you just went to a strip club and they had a pole and you asked if you could go up there and everybody was like, oh my God, wow, look at her go.
That was in Cancun. That was actually in Cancun at
That's
a nightclub.
Yes. Yeah.
I love tall poles because there was a couple, like Cheetahs didn't have tall poles, but Spearman Rhino had a really tall pole. So I did like that when I worked there. They had a super tall pole, but in Cancun, that pole was the tallest pole I ever danced on. That was really awesome. But yeah, I miss pole dancing, honestly. I just went to Country Thunder a week ago. And some of the camps, they have stripper poles on platforms. And I was like, oh my gosh, I haven't done this in like 4 years. I didn't go upside down, but I was like, I just gotta go up there. And I did. I spun around in like three different spins, and I was like, this is really fun.
You know, you could
but
put
it was
one in
such
your
a rush.
You could put one in the front room, Naomi.
I have one actually. Outside. It's outside on a platform, but I haven't pulled it out since I became a mom.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I used to have it in my other place before we bought this place.
It's a workout.
It's a huge workout. I know. I was like, I got super tired because I'm not used to like doing that kind of stuff anymore when I was at Country Thunder. But yeah. It's very good exercise and super fun.
And just to let you know, if you haven't already deduced that I did read the entire book, Risa was not a favorite name of yours.
No, not at first. I hated it. I was like, this is the most horrible name. But the girl's like, at least it's yours. Like, no one else has it. And guys always thought I said Lisa. And it kind of became really awesome because when they would say, oh, nice to meet you, Lisa, I would say, no, it's like Lisa, but with an R, Risa. And then it was like a conversation starter. And they're like, wow, I've never met anyone with that name. And I had that stage name the longest from 2004 until 2020.
And because it's a foreign name that has a meaning, right?
Yes, it means laughter in Spanish.
Okay. That's kind of flattering that another dancer gave that to you then.
Well, she worked at Spearmint Rhino. It was like a week and I didn't have my own name. And like the girls were talking about and some of the regulars are like, oh, you don't have your name. Like you're changing your name every day and throughout your shifts. And I was like, there's just so many girls. Like all the names seem to be taken. So she was like, and I never really talked to her until then. She's like, you need your own name. And I was like, yes. And she's like, come on, let me help you. And she takes me to the dressing room and she's shouting out names. And I'm like, no, these are not, they don't fit me. And when she got to Reese's, she's like, oh my gosh, it's perfect. It means laughter. And it's, you're bubbly. It's perfect for you. And I was like, I don't like it. She's like, that's why you don't have a name. You're too picky. This is going to be your name. And I was like, fine. I was not happy, but in the end, I'm grateful for her. And I did end up liking it, but it took me a long time to get used to it.
Wasn't Sugar one of yours as well?
Yes, that was in Michigan at Sensations for 4 years. I was Sugar. And uh-huh. That was also a girl. She's like, oh my gosh, you're so sweet. Sugar should be your name. And she's like, I was like, they won't believe me. My name is Sugar. And she's like, they don't give you enough money to know your real name. I was like, okay. So I thought that was funny. She was one of the girls that taught me a lot of pole tricks. She was really good on the pole. She actually teaches pole classes now.
What is the typical clientele that you dealt with when you were stripping?
I preferred the older gentlemen, actually. I don't know. For some reason, the younger guys would make me nervous, or I felt like they were just there looking for a date. And not that the older guys weren't sometimes, because they were. And I'm probably judgmental. I always felt like the older guys probably had more money and I was there to make money. I wasn't there looking for dates. I was there to work. But I feel like the majority of my clientele was like, the like middle-aged men, maybe like 35 to older, or sometimes even in like maybe younger than 35. But I didn't often go up to guys that when I thought they were like in their 20s. I don't know. I was actually intimidated and uncomfortable to walk up to them.
Well, was there maybe a psychological component to you gravitating towards the older gentleman because of that kind of distant relationship you had with your own father?
That's what I feel like. Absolutely. I feel like that always made me more gravitate towards the older men because of that.
Yeah. Has your family read the book? Do they know about the book? Do they know about your life?
I just found out last week, someone reached out to me on Instagram. He's like, I'm a really good friend of your family and a lot of the Amish where you grew up. And I was driving around your brother and I started asking him about the strict rules. And he started telling this man, my brother, told this man about the relationship I have with my parents. And then he tells the man about my book. And he's like, if you ever get the book, like, please let me read it. And I guess this man went and bought the book and he read it. And he's like, don't worry, I will not let him read it. I will not even tell him that I have it because I don't think that he would understand what you went through.
Right.
Now, I have talked to not my parents, but some of my siblings, a lot of my siblings, I've talked to them about some of the drug abuse. Because during my years of addiction, I was more absent. I didn't go see them very often. And a couple of times I did, I was not in good shape. Like I was just a hot mess. And they knew I was up to something, but they didn't know what. So I guess to give them closure, like they ask me a little bit about it sometimes when I visit it. And I actually, not in detail like I go in the book, but I've told them that I smoked crack and I did coke and stuff like that. But I don't know. So they know I have a book. I don't know if my parents know that I was a stripper, but I feel like it would be naive to think that they don't, because they somehow find out everything. But we've never talked about it. So, oh, sorry, my phone is ringing.
That's okay.
They've never talked about it, and I don't feel comfortable talking to them about it.
You know, what's interesting is we've talked about how growing up Amish did not prepare you for being English in life outside of Amishville. However, I think that there are parts of growing up Amish that did prepare you for your life as a stripper and a call girl, and that is the amount of secrecy that you had to carry. You know, you can't lie in the Amish community, so you pretty much have to keep things bottled up.
Well, right.
I think you pretty much had to keep things bottled up in the English life, and you had to become a very good liar.
Exactly. Absolutely. And also, this, even besides that, yes, I agree with that 100%. And also, I feel like the strong foundation that I had growing up Amish, I feel like that's what gave me the strength to get through all of that and come outside on the other side. Because I often, when I was down in the dumps and didn't know where I was going to go or what I was going to do, I thought about my family and how they would feel, or like, I don't know. I just wanted to be better and do better, because I didn't want my family. I don't know. I just thought about my family a lot. I didn't want them to worry, or I know they worried, but I didn't want them to see me as this bad person. And I wanted to do better and live a better life.
How did you kick the drug habit?
Well, getting away from crack, I moved to Las Vegas. And then in Las Vegas, I did a lot of ecstasy and Molly. And I even smoked meth a couple times with my boyfriend there. But that reminded me of the crack, and I quickly was done with that. And then I did a lot of, even when I moved to California for 6 years, and my boyfriend there, he didn't like drugs, and I would hype that I was doing coke and Molly and ecstasy from him. And I guess how I was able to kick it was with my current partner. Like, he would always tell me, like, if I ever want to have kids, like, I have to take care of my body. And he's like, people that do hard drugs like you have in your past, he's like, they often die in their 40s. And that really opened my eyes. Like, he, a lot of, like, not, I don't know about a lot, but a few of his favorite rappers and people like that that were into coke, they die in their early 40s. So he always told me about that. And he's like, if you keep doing this, you're going to die. And that really opened my eyes. And then I wanted to become a mother. And I was like, well, if I want to be a mom, I have to get my body healthy. And that's really how I stopped.
So you did not go to any meetings, or it was just a personal decision? Yes. And you used your own inner strength to stick to it?
Yes, willpower and inner strength, and yes.
And when was the last time you used?
In 2018 was the last time I used coke.
Wow, good for you, buddy.
Yeah, I don't even drink alcohol now. Like, at Country Thunder, I opened up like one of those little Malibus, kind of like a White Claw, and I took one sip, and I was like, whoa, it just, to me, it, when I, even when I just take a sip of alcohol now, it feels like poison in my body.
Yeah. Well,
so
most of that reason is because you're not doing it to fulfill a void, because those voids have been filled now.
Right.
You know, you have love from a partner and you have a baby girl.
Yes. You know? And I feel like writing my book, I never realized it, and that wasn't like part of the plan when I started writing the book, but writing the book was super therapeutic, and I was able to release a lot of the trauma that I had, and I'm on a healing journey now. And I don't need drugs to get me through like I used to, or to just to function like I felt like I couldn't function before without drugs.
Yeah. Well, being on a healing journey, you have to be present. You know, healing is because you're present. And if you're right. taking drugs, you ain't present.
Absolutely not. You're just shoving it down and covering it up and just trying to numb the pain. At least that's how I felt, like what I would do.
Yeah. So congratulations to you on making that decision and being able to stick to it. But I mean, you look great. You look happy. You look healthy. You don't look like the same person I read about.
Yeah, no, I found the peace and the freedom that I was looking for when I left Amish. Uh-huh. It took me 20 years, but I'm finally here. And I'm grateful for that. And I'm grateful for my partner to be so loving and supportive of me and accepting me for who I am and just being by my side. Like, I don't have any family out here in Arizona where I am, but he's amazing. And I'm really grateful for him. And I'm grateful for my strength and where I am now.
Biggest regret.
Biggest regret. There's two. Okay. I have two biggest regrets. The one is going back to the Amish for the second and making them believe that I was there to stay. And the second one is hitting that crack pipe for the first time and doing that first line of coke. Like, those are my biggest regrets, definitely.
Was the grass greener?
Yes, I feel like it is now. It wasn't for a long time, but absolutely now.
Okay.
I'm very happy and I live a very peaceful life. I live on 4 acres and I have chickens, a garden, and we have a daughter, and it's peace. My life is very peaceful.
I think you're going to be a fantastic mom. And I say that because you have a firsthand knowledge of what oppression and repression can do to somebody, you know? And I don't think that means that you're going to be willy-nilly with your daughter, but I think it also means that you're going to have a capability that somebody else doesn't have in child rearing because you came from such a situation.
I always tell her everything in moderation. Like I allow her, for example, soda. She gets a tiny bit once in a blue moon. And that's just an example. Like, I feel, or she would just eat chocolate all day if I would let her, or snacks, but I don't. And I tell her in moderation, because if I know if I repress her from these things, when she gets older, she might just go crazy and rebel like I did. Just like, drink a whole bunch of soda and eat a whole bunch of chocolate. And I don't want that to happen to her. So I allow her to have like a little bit here and there versus none at all.
You know what I find?
Makes sense.
It does make sense. Yeah. Everything in moderation. That's a great motto and a great philosophy to have in life.
Yes.
You know,
I don't want to repress her.
Well, because we've all seen how that turns out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not the way to go. Definitely not.
One of the heartwarming things that I love about the book, it's towards the end, and it is the relationship that your mother has with your daughter.
Oh, it's so heartwarming, and it almost makes me cry sometimes when I think about it, because she just loves, my daughter loves my parents, and they just love her. Like, my mom, like, I never seen her dance in her life, but my daughter was like 15 months old and singing, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. And she had my mom dancing. Like, I was like, what? Like, I wished I could record it, but I can't do that there. But these are memories and things that, you know, I will tell her when she's a little bit older.
Well, doesn't grandpa play peekaboo?
Yes. And grandpa was playing peekaboo and hide and seek and bouncing her on his knee. Like, it's so heartwarming. Like, they just adore her. My dad, like, the last time I was there was a year ago in June. It'll be a year in June. And he teased her with, she has this bear that she loves. And he'd be like, oh, I'm going to snuggle the bear. And she's like, no, Dottie. She calls him mommy, and Dottie means grandpa and grandpa. And she would get so offended when Dottie would try to cuddle the bear, but it was cute. Like, he didn't make her cry or anything, but it was really fun.
Had you experienced that at her age with your dad, would you have left?
No, probably not. I mean, I can't say for sure, but most likely not. If I would have had like all that nurturing and loving care and like interaction, maybe that's not the right word, but just there, like, yeah, they were there for me like that. Might have been different.
What's your greatest victory?
My greatest victory is overcoming my drug habits, definitely.
Okay.
Actually, and becoming a mom, because I was told I couldn't be a mom. So that is probably the greatest victory, because at 40, I was told I couldn't have kids and I finally gave up. And 5 months later, I was pregnant with our daughter. And this is by far the greatest chapter of my life. It's challenging at times, but it's the most rewarding. And I'm just so grateful that I was able to become a mom. And my daughter is just so loving and amazing and so smart and fun. She has such a fun personality, and I'm very grateful for her.
Tough question. I got to ask it. What's more demeaning, stripping for strangers, having sex with strangers, or buying drugs?
Having sex with strangers, probably.
Yeah.
I feel like that's like the biggest taboo among like the other people that just people in general, like they probably look down on me more for being, you know, having sex with strangers.
How did you deal with that personally in your own mind, in your own soul?
I'm on a healing journey. It was something that I had to forgive myself. I had a lot of guilt for a long time. Like I would feel super guilty. And like in my book, I talk about how many guys would have, like sometimes I would have sex seven guys in one day when I would go to Vegas, just so I could support myself financially. And that was really soul crushing. Mm-hmm. And I just had to forgive myself. And I was doing it so I could support myself financially because I didn't want to depend on anyone else. And I had just gone to college and spent $20,000, yet I couldn't support myself on the $11 an hour in LA that I made from my being a phlebotomist. Like it was a challenging time, but definitely, yeah.
It's interesting that you say that, you know, kicking the drug habit, becoming a mom. Nowhere in there did you say that graduating from college and getting a degree was a major triumph for you.
You know, I forget about that sometimes because that was a huge deal to me, actually. I was so proud of myself and I'm still proud of myself. But I got my phlebotomy, x-ray technician and medical assistant license all in 1 year and I graduated. I was just on top of the world. Like it was like the greatest feeling ever. And I was like, I'm never going to be a stripper or prostitute ever in my life again. Like I was just so excited. And early on, after I got hired and I only made $11 an hour and I had to pay the student loan and my car payment and stuff, and I realized that I couldn't live off that living in LA, and it kind of really crushed me. Mm-hmm. But that was such a huge thing for me to graduate from college. I'm really proud of myself, but I don't do that now, but I still have my licenses.
Yeah. What do you do now?
I am a content creator and a stay-at-home mom.
What do you create?
I do TikTok and Instagram. I'm Amish Inspiration on both of them. And mm-hmm. I just do stories about things about my life, even growing up Amish, or about my life now.
And why do you dress in Amish attire sometimes for your TikTok?
How do Amish women ride horses? Now, I don't know about all the Amish, but the Schwarzentruber Amish, which is the way I grew up, the women were not allowed to ride horses when I was there. I think it helps to like get people to understand where I came from the Amish. I know some people get mad. They're like, why do you dress like this if you're not Amish? And also my daughter, she loves to wear her Amish dress. My mom made her Amish dress and she often says, Mom, I want to wear my Amish dress. So we wear our Amish dress together. And it just to bring awareness, like, I don't know. I know people get mad sometimes, but it's makes me feel happy to wear my Amish dress. Those are my roots.
And your hope with the book is what?
I hope to give them hope and inspire them. Like, I really, really hope that I already know that it does because I often get messages on TikTok or Instagram and they're like, wow, your story is amazing. You're giving me hope. Like, I'm still living my story right now, but I too hope one day I can overcome what I'm going through the way you did. So that makes me feel, I don't know, it sometimes brings tears to my eyes because I wish I could go help them, but I know that they have to like be ready to move on and get well. But I encourage them to get support and, you know, people there for them to help them get through it.
It brings tears to your eyes, but does it also bring a sense of anger that nobody was there for you when you were going through it?
Sometimes It does, but I always feel like I was responsible for myself to get out of it because I'm the one that got myself there. Like I knew that if anyone was going to get me out of there, it was me, because people tried to help me and I wasn't ready. Mm-hmm. Like Dan, for example, like he's like, come here, you can get well. But at that time, I just, for some reason, I wasn't ready to change or to be better. I was sick somehow and I needed help, but I didn't accept it. So yeah. I really hope that my story inspires others and that they too can heal and move forward and have a good life.
Now, like I said at the beginning, there are parts of the book where I just wanted to shake you by the shoulders and just wake you up. And now I just want to hug you, kid.
Oh, thank you.
You're very welcome. Well, I'm very proud to know you, to have met you, and just super, super glad that you're on the path that you're on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Me too.
I'm sure really you are. Grateful. Yeah, yes, I'm sure you are.
Absolutely. Every day I wake up is a great day, and I'm grateful to get another chance at life.
And congratulate that partner of yours and give Stormy a big hug from us, okay?
I sure will. Absolutely.
Where can they go to pick up your book?
Amazon.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but it's on Amazon.
Yeah, so I downloaded it from Amazon on my Kindle.
Yeah, that's where they, and if they go to my website, it just takes them to Amazon.
Okay.
Like that's where it's available. So.
Yeah. And it's a quick read. It is a very quick read. And I would suggest reading it alone.
I know, right? I know, right? I know for some people it's overwhelming or overbearing. It's too much for some people. They're like, it's porn. Like I got a couple of reviews. They're like, it's too pornographic. I'm like, it says erotic memoir. Like, what were you expecting?
Oh yeah, it'll make you blush. It'll make you blush.
Exactly.
But it is it's a true triumphant story of what you went through, what you overcame. You'll be angry at times. You'll be frustrated at times, and then you'll celebrate at times. And I think that's a well-rounded book.
Thank you. I think so, and I hope that, like I said, I hope it inspires people and gives them hope. So,
and I think it will do just that. The Amazing Adventures of an Amish Stripper, an erotic memoir, serves as a cautionary tale on the ramifications of oppression, the financial and physical cost of drug addiction, and the mental toll the search for belonging can bring. In the end, though, Naomi's story is a triumph, proving that with determination, perseverance, and love, we can overcome anything. My thanks to Naomi Swartzentruber for joining me. Again, you can get Naomi's book, The Amazing Adventures of an Amish Stripper, an Erotic Memoir, at Amazon, and you can follow her on Instagram at Amish Inspiration. If you'd be kind enough to give the Fuzzy Mic a rating, I would be grateful. And please, subscribe to the Fuzzy Mic YouTube channel and share the Fuzzy Mic with all of your contacts. Thank you. I appreciate you for doing that. The Fuzzy Mic is hosted and produced by Kevin Klein. Production elements by Zach Sheesh at the Radio Farm. Social media director is Trish Klein. For a weekly dose of hiccup-inducing laughter, check out the Tuttle and Klein podcast. It's the podcast I co-host with my longtime radio partner of 25 years, Tim Tuttle. We give you new episodes every Wednesday. I'll be back next week with a new episode of The Fuzzy Mic. I hope you'll join me then. And thank you for listening.
That's it for The Fuzzy Mic. Thank you. The Fuzzy Mic with Kevin Klein. Fuzzy Mic.